Good afternoon, you're very welcome to Saturday with Clare Byrne. We'll be heading to Wexford today, where the Sinn Féin Ardéis is underway. We'll examine the announcement of plans for new open disclosure legislation for hospitals involved in medical negligence cases. Alcohol sponsorship escapes a ban again as new controls around drink are on the way, and RTE's decision to pay compensation in the homophobia row. News first, though, with Michael Murphy.
Good afternoon. The National Coordination Group has said the full resources of the state at both national and local government level are available to deal with the current phase of bad weather, and that it will continue to monitor the situation closely. After a meeting today, the group noted that after last night's heavy rain, there are no reports of major flooding. Met Éireann has reiterated that the current unsettled weather is likely to continue well into next week, and stormy conditions are being reported along the south coast this afternoon. Michael O'Regan is the officer in charge of the Goleen Coast Guard Unit in West Cork.
Well, I would say to the people in the area and the surrounding areas not to go anywhere near piers, beaches, just to keep well back and not to go out at all. I think they're better off just staying away from the sea. What we find mostly is, like, if you're walking down near a cliff or anything, the wind can suck you off. The sheer force at the moment, there is no way. If it hit you, you just couldn't retain your balance.
The United Nations is due to take a convoy of aid into an area of the Syrian city of Homs, where about 2,500 people are trapped. Yesterday, over 80 women, children and the elderly were taken out of the besieged city. Greg Barrow of the United Nations World Food Programme said some of them had been speaking about the conditions they'd had to endure.
Bread not available for 5 months, people gathering weeds and leaves and stores of olives to eat, and what little supplies of bulgur wheat that is available inside this area infested with insects, so it's almost inedible, but people being forced to eat that kind of food.
A post-mortem examination is to be carried out following the death of a 3-month-old baby girl in hospital in Belfast 2 days after she was admitted with serious injuries. The infant's father appeared in court yesterday, accused of causing her grievous bodily harm. Here's Brendan Wright of our Northern staff.
Baby Cara Walsh, who was 3 months old, was taken to the Royal Victoria Hospital on Wednesday from a flat in the Twinbrook Estate in West Belfast. The infant was critically ill and had suffered severe head injuries. Following police inquiries, the baby's father, 23-year-old Christopher O'Neill, was arrested and charged with causing his daughter grievous bodily harm. The court was told that Christopher O'Neill had found the baby in some sort of medical distress and had taken actions to try and help her. A few hours after that court hearing, baby Cara Walsh died in hospital. A post-mortem examination is to be carried out. The PSNI said detectives would be consulting with the Public Prosecution Service in relation to the case. Brendan Wright, RTE News, Belfast.
Sport now. And one of the games of the RBS Six Nations Championship will be underway in just under an hour and a half. Ireland are taking on back-to-back champions Wales in a hugely anticipated showdown. From the Aviva Stadium, Justin Tracy reports.
Ever since Brian O'Driscoll was dropped for the final Lions test, this game took on a whole new meaning. Both camps have been at pains to say it won't have a bearing, but what happened in Australia last summer has given a needle fixture an added edge. Right throughout the morning, Lansdowne Road and all routes to the ground have been buzzing with anticipation. Such is the magnitude of this game that a win here very much sets up either team for a shot at the Grand Slam. It's set to be tight, intensely physical, with both sides knowing that the first to blink will likely go home the beaten team. It all kicks off at 2:30. Justin Tracy, RTE News, Lansdowne Road.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Liberty Insurance. Helping homes get great cover and great value.
Strong to gale force south to southwest winds will continue today, and it will be stormy off the south coast this afternoon as winds veer westerly there. The strong winds will be accompanied by heavy showers, with some of the showers possibly turning thundery this afternoon. Highest temperatures of 6 to 8 degrees. There will be further heavy or prolonged showers tonight, with a continued risk of thunder. There's a warning of southwest to west, strong gale to storm force winds today on coasts from Cairnsore Point to Mizenhead to Loophead, and of southerly gales or strong gales this afternoon and this evening on coasts from Fairhead to Hoathhead to Cairnsore Point and on the Irish Sea. That's the news for the moment. Back now to Clare.
Michael, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. You're very welcome to the programme and we'd like to hear from you today. You can text us on 51551, email saturday@rte.ie and the Twitter address is @SaturdayRTE. First today, the Sinn Féin Ardhéis is underway in Wexford. A little earlier, I spoke to Vice President of the party, Mary Lou MacDonald, and I began by asking her about last night's debate at the Ardhéis, where it was proposed that members should have a free vote on abortion.
Well, we have discussed this matter now over the last number of Ardhéisne, and last night again we addressed the matter. This isn't actually about the whip, Clare. What's at issue here is the function of the Ardhéis itself, because what happens within Sinn Féin is that every year delegates come from across the country, motions are put, motions are democratically debated and decisions are taken. And of course, in the course of those debates, whatever the issue, you have different strands of opinions and different views. But we are very strongly of the view that once the democratic decision is taken by the party, not by the leadership, but by delegates from the grassroots, well, then that policy position has to be binding on all Sinn Féin elected representatives.
But you personally want to see everybody of one voice in these matters.
I personally and the party absolutely respects that there are differences of opinion on the issue of abortion, perhaps most particularly. But the same would be the case across a range of issues. I'm very firmly of the view that people have a right and a responsibility to express those views, to debate things openly and democratically. But I'm also firmly of the view that once you take a democratic decision on a policy issue, well, then that's the decision. And that's how we operate. And of course, from one Ardhéis to another, policies are revisited, they're refined, they're considered. But ultimately, for us to be a coherent and effective political party, you have to take policy decisions, you have to articulate those positions, and ultimately, of course, seek to deliver on your policy view. And the other thing to say, Clare, is this. Very often, the issue of conscience is only cited in respect of issues like abortion. The truth is that conscience and conscientious considerations are core to political debate on virtually every single topic. And whereas people do have very strong, very deeply held views on the issue of abortion, and I respect that, we as a political party have to have a coherent position on it, because this is a matter that affects women's health. It's a matter of public policy. It is also a matter of conscience, and people are free to express those views, and believe you me, they do.
But they're not really free, because Paula Tobin, we know, is back in the party again, but he was out for a time on the head of this issue. So when you say free to express them, they certainly are, but they have to pay a price.
I don't accept that, and Pather is very welcome back into the party. He's a very valued colleague. Pather was up on his feet at the Ardhéis, setting out his position democratically, fully and very articulately, and he's entitled to do that. And other delegates set out their view. And then at the end of the debate, a vote is taken, and then the Sinn Féin position is decided.
But my point is, he was out of the party for a time after he decided to vote his own way on the abortion legislation.
That's right. And Pather understood, as we all understand, that it is not for any of us to second guess the decision of a Sinn Féin or a Ardhéis. And it is important to stress, Clare, that it is the grassroots, it's the membership of Sinn Féin that come together annually and debate policy and set policy. And then all of us, when we go forward for election as public representatives, know before ever our name goes on a ballot paper that part of the understanding is that we respect the decision of Ardhéisne and that we respect party policy positions.
Okay.
And I don't think that that's an onerous thing. I think it's just a reasonable democratic thing and a democratic way to operate.
And do you expect that the gay marriage referendum will throw up similar problems for you?
I don't think so.
Has Pather Tobin indicated what his position will be on gay marriage?
Not that I am sure of. I assume, to be honest with you, Claire, I haven't had a conversation with him specifically on that matter, but he would be aware, as all of us are aware, of the Sinn Féin position on it. Again, this is an issue that has been considered by Sinn Féin members, the length and breadth of Ireland. It has been debated, it has been discussed, and the position of Sinn Féin collectively is in support of marriage equality, in support of the rights of gay citizens. We don't believe that they should be discriminated against. And it is the members of the party who have arrived at that position, and it's the Ardesh that has sanctioned that position. This isn't a case of the leadership of the party imposing its view. It's a very democratic
vote.
And a very fair and equal process.
Can we move on to what I'm sure is the major focus there this weekend, the local and European elections? At the moment, you have 50 city and county councillors. What gains do you need to make, in your view, in order to be successful in May?
Well, we will be fielding across Ireland, North and South, in excess of 350 candidates. I believe we will be in a position in these elections to say to people that irrespective of where you live in Ireland, you will have the opportunity to vote for a Sinn Féin candidate. Obviously, we're looking to make gains, and we're confident that we will. We have a slate of very, very able and impressive candidates at local and indeed at European level.
How many do you want to get into the city and county councils?
I want to get in as many as we possibly can. And I believe that in terms of the candidates that we're fielding, each and every single one of them, every woman, every man that we are fielding are capable, credible candidates that can represent their communities, whether at a local level or at an EU level. And in terms of the candidates for the European Parliament, we have three very strong women: Martina Anderson, who is a sitting MEP in the North, Lynn Boylan, who will be contesting in Dublin and who spoke here this morning, Leanne Riada, who will be representing the South and who equally is here and given a very strong account of herself during this Ardesh, and Matt Carthy in the Northwest.
Just on
each
that,
of the, each of those yeah, are very, very fine candidates, and I believe
I'm sure they are
fine,
but you know,
parliamentarians.
You know that when it comes to European elections, they're often presidential style campaigns, and the well-known person wins the day. Now, you don't have any, I'm loath to use the word celebrity, but I'm going to use it anyway, celebrity candidates in the sense that you've got well-known people on the ballot paper. That's not the case, is it?
Well, we certainly don't have celebrity candidates. I wouldn't wish us to.
Well-known people, then.
Well-known. Well, you have to consider that, of course, when somebody isn't a household name, you have a bigger task in terms of building their profile and for people to get a sense of them and to get to hear them and to get to know them. But I think, and we think, that at this time, in particular perhaps in Irish political life, it is important to have new blood. It is important to have new people coming on the scene with a fresh voice, with new energy. And certainly in the case of Lynn Boylan in Dublin and Leanne Riada in the South and Matt Carthy, who is in fact elected to the local authority in Monaghan, you have that. I don't accept that you have to be a TD for 10 or 15 years to be a credible candidate for the European Parliament, or indeed, more importantly, to do a very good job for your constituents when you get to the European Parliament. Bear in mind, Claire, when I ran in the European election in 2004, I was an unknown quantity. I hadn't been elected to any other body. And I think we need to get away from this idea that it's the same old people, and we sort of recycle them through the Dáil and into the European Parliament. There's plenty of work to be done politically. There's plenty of space for new people, for women, for younger people to come forward and to take on a representative role. And we've been saying that for a very long time. As you know, I'm a very strong advocate of more women in Irish political life and younger people in Irish political life. And I think we're putting our money where our mouth is in terms of our selection of European Union candidates.
I want to ask you about one issue in particular, which looks as though it's looming large as an election issue as we head towards May, and that is pylons. Now, Sinn Féin has already said that the review announced by government is a pre-election stunt, but what are you saying you would do about the entire thing?
Well, we are anxious, obviously, that the country as a whole gets the infrastructure that we need. So this isn't against, for instance, the North-South interconnector. or against any of the infrastructure in the country. But we recognise and have recognised for many years the deeply held concerns of communities right across the country, north and south, east and west, in respect of these pylons. We know that people are concerned about the effects on the environment. They're concerned about health issues. And those concerns have not been adequately addressed. In fact,
so are you saying we should have more reports then?
It took, well, what we want is an objective assessment. And what we have said is that the wise thing to do is to do objectively and independently a cost assessment in respect of undergrounding. That's what we want to happen. And the government, for some reason, despite the controversy that has raged on this issue, is steadfast in its opposition to that. I don't understand why that is the case. I would have thought, given the level of public concern, and you can see that in the over 30,000 submissions that have been made from right across the country, I would have thought the politically sensible and responsive thing to do would be to make a full assessment of the costs of undergrounding, so we're not speculating anymore, and to establish in an objective way what is the best way forward so that we can provide the infrastructure but also protect our environment and allay any fears that there might be in respect of human health.
That was Mary Lou MacDonald speaking to me a little earlier from the Sinn Féin Ordesh in Wexford, and we go there again now and to our reporter Barry Lenehan, who joins us. Barry, it's a big moment for Sinn Féin. Positive polls and the European and local elections on the way. Is that big moment reflected in the mood there this weekend, would you say?
I'd say definitely, Claire. It's really a defiant and a buoyant mood is how I describe the mood here in Wexford Opera House. I mean, the biggest applause at the Ardesh last night and the loudest cheers came when the chairman of Sinn Féin, Declan Carney, criticised what he termed as the vilification of Gerry Adams over the past year. And you mentioned those polls and those election campaigns. Now, this morning, we've had several keynote addresses from delegates from across the country, which were, of course, carried live on RTE television, and were very much a chance for those local election candidates to show themselves off, so to speak. I suppose the one dampener on things, really, 1,500 delegates were expected here at the Opera House across the 2 days. Between 500 and 600 turned up last night. And organisers are fearful, Claire, that numbers today mightn't be as high as they'd hoped for due to the bad weather. But apart from that, Claire, I'd say very much buoyant and defiant would be the words I describe it here in Wexford.
And Barry, I spoke there to Mary Lou about that debate last night about voting with your conscience, and in particular, I suppose, Pádraig Tobin addressing it after he was suspended from the party because he voted against the party when it came to abortion legislation. Was it a contentious battle last night?
Yeah, without doubt, Claire, it was quite a spiky, full-on debate is how I describe it. I mean, Pádraig Tobin, as you alluded to, he lost the whip last summer over the opposition to the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill. He actually received, he's back in the party now, and he actually received a very, very warm applause as he took to the podium to speak on the motion. And he remarked that he'd rather wear a Dublin jersey down the streets of Navan, he being, of course, a Mead man, than to have to revisit the issue of a free vote on abortion being so soon back in the party ranks. But yeah, a very tempestuous debate. Around 15 party Chumann had proposed the motion, and many speakers went radically over time in their contribution on the motion. And I know you were speaking to Mary Lou MacDonald there. She was one of those who spoke against it. She did so on behalf of the party's Ord Cuirla. But the motion was, as expected, very well defeated. But of all the motions last night and today, Claire, it was definitely the one which garnered the most debate, the most argument, and I suppose caused the biggest furrow of them all.
I suppose so. In general, the focus is very firmly on the local and European elections, Barry.
Oh yeah, very much so. Yeah, that date is very much ring-fenced in the calendar here in Wexford today. I mean, many of the policies that delegates have voted through and will vote on this evening, you could say they're very much popular stances and what political commentators would say are key issues in the upcoming elections. I know you mentioned pylons there with Mary Lou MacDonald. Delegates have voted on a motion insisting that the government only use underground power cables in any future plans later today, while anti-pylon groups have also been invited to the Opera House to meet Sinn Féin members and representatives later this evening. On the issue of the European elections, and I know, you touched upon this with Mary Lou, the question around Sinn Féin's candidates in those elections in the four constituencies is not will they get elected, but rather more simply, who are they? All four have low profiles nationally, and perhaps in an attempt to remedy that from party headquarters, Sinn Féin is giving its candidate in the South constituency, Leanna Ní Riada, some exposure on national television tonight. She'll introduce Gerry Adams ahead of that presidential address. That address will be carried live on television at 8:30. And you'd think, Claire, that Gerry Adams will use it to appeal to the electorate and get the ball rolling ahead of those local and European election campaigns. But before all that, Claire, and before we came on air, I sampled the atmosphere among Sinn Féin party members here at the Opera House in Wexford.
Councillor McNugent, Cox City. The mood is good, it's positive. The message is that there's an alternative to the Conservative parties, the parties of austerity, that we're a radical alternative, and we're hoping that people will support us.
My name is Emer O'Shukru, and I'm a new member, and I'm running for the Ard Corla. I'm an environmentalist of about 18 years standing, and I feel Sinn Féin is our last chance, essentially to deal with the financial crisis, which is linked in many ways to the environmental crisis.
Youth is on the rise within Sinn Féin. Currently in Belfast alone, we have 60 members of what's called the Maria Farrell Republican Youth Committee. Sinn Féin has a past, yes, Sinn Féin does have a past, and we're not afraid to talk about that past. But what we want to do is, now at this hour, is talk about the future.
Angus O'Snodick, TD, Dublin South Central. Sinn Féin has a president, has endorsed him time after time, and kind of the vilification that we've seen in the last year, in particular against Gerry Adams, has had no founding and is a disgrace, and that shouldn't happen to Gerry or anybody else.
I wouldn't want to put a specific figure on it, but I would say I would like to see us the majority in opposition this time, but I think we're only a couple of elections out from forming a coalition government, but I would like to see us as the senior partner, not the junior partner.
Delegates at the Sinn Féin Ardéis speaking to our reporter Barry Lenehan. And now Brian Dowling from RTÉ's political staff is with me in the studio now. Brian, we want to talk about really where Sinn Féin are at the moment as they face into the local and European elections. So give me your assessment of what's going on with the party.
I think if you look back, perhaps, and if you look at where Sinn Féin have come from, and it might give you some sense of what their potential is in the local and the European elections. And I think perhaps the emphasis more on the local elections rather than the European elections, because the local elections give you a measure of the national base of support for the party. And if you go back, say, to 2007, to the general election in 2007, the party took just a little under 7% of the national first preference vote. If you move ahead to 2009, to the last local elections, the party had a very small increase, literally less, barely 1%, just under 8%.
And that gave them the 50 seats.
That gave them 50 seats in the city councils and the county councils. But actually, they have 127 seats if you include all the smaller boroughs and urban district councils, many of which are gone now, which is another factor to remember about the next set of European elections. There's a big, big reduction in the number of councillors nationally. So as between all the parties, they are all fighting for a smaller slice of a smaller cake. Mm-hmm. That said, if you move ahead to 2011, to the general election 2011, at that stage, Sinn Féin's vote had grown to just around 10% of the national vote. So if you take, say, from 2007 up to 2011, they've come 3% up. Now, if you look what's happened since then, from, say, summer of last year up to now, the party, if you take Red Sea polling, which is month-on-month tracking, they are consistently polling between 16 and 17%. If they were able to translate that in the local elections into actual votes and into actual seats, you would have to expect the party will do particularly well. They will make a lot of gains. The big question is, do they have the organisation in parts of the country to actually capitalise on that support? And I think that's a big question. If you look at, say, the local elections, and if you look at a map of the local elections, the Sinn Féin support tends to be concentrated from the border counties down around Cumming, Donegal, down around Sligo, Cavan, Monaghan. After that, the support is concentrated in urban areas. There are huge parts of the country through the Midlands, that kind of territory, where there's very little Sinn Féin presence in terms of elected representatives. So they still have a big job ahead of them in putting together the kind of local organisation and machinery that could deliver seats if that vote is there, that percentage vote.
OK, now we pulled you away from the Week in Politics, which you're working on for tomorrow, but you're covering the European constituency of Midlands North West. I know you travelled that this week. I mean, what's your sense from what you found out?
It's very early, I think, at this stage to get a sense of the public mood. We went on a road trip basically to meet all the candidates who are in the field at the moment. I think the first thing that's very striking is the sheer size of the constituency. This is 15 counties. It is huge. And we're talking about a constituency that stretches on the east coast from Meath, Louth, across to Galway, into Mayo, up to Donegal, down the border counties, going as far south as Kildare and Laois. So it's a huge mix of urban areas, rural areas, and the issues then are sort of national issues as distinct from local issues. And I think that for all of the candidates, the capacity to canvass this area is really, really difficult. It'll be more difficult for independents. Political parties have organisations. They should be able to make a presence felt across most of the constituency. I think independent candidates will find this a difficult constituency.
And Sinn Féin have very high hopes for their candidate in that constituency.
They have McCarthy running in this constituency. One would expect that if Sinn Féin can bring out the kind of vote that it has in those border areas and down from Donegal, Cavan, Monaghan into Louth, there should be a reasonable first preference vote. But it's still, there are four seats, and if you look at the existing lineup, Marion Harkin is running again, an existing MEP. The two Fine Gael MEPs, because they're now in the one constituency, Jim Higgins and Mairead McGuinness, are both contesting this. It's expected that Pat de Cope Gallagher has informally declared, but that he will be in the race. I would expect he will be in the race. So there are four sitting MEPs already there.
OK, Brian, we'll let you go. Thank you very much for joining us. And more from Brian Dowling on The Week in Politics on RTE tomorrow. And my thanks also to Barry Lenehan in Wexford. Now, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with the Minister for Agriculture, Simon Coveney, and Independent TD, Roisin Shortall. You're listening to Saturday with Clare Byrne, and joining us now from our Cork studio, we have Minister for Agriculture Simon Coveney, and here in Dublin, Independent TD Roisin Shortall. Before we move on, Minister Coveney, I want to come to you first because we know one of the big stories is the weather, and I know in your area people are particularly affected. What news have you got for us then on what's happening right now?
Well, it's still very stormy and it was a very, very wet night. What we don't have, thank God, anymore is extremely high spring tides, because in a city like Cork, and also to a certain extent in Limerick, when you have storm force winds coming from the southeast like we had, which essentially causes a tidal surge in Cork Harbour and up the River Lee, when you have a lot of rainfall coming down the River Lee, and when you have a city built on a marsh, you have a recipe for very bad flooding, and that's what's happened now for 2 days in the last week. What we now have is tides that are more normal, so we're unlikely to have widespread flooding from a tidal point of view, but we certainly have very heavy rain and very strong winds. Yesterday I was in Galway and Clare looking at the coastal damage from the storms. And I suspect we will have got more coastal damage, particularly in the southwest last night, because of the extreme weather fronts coming through just one after the other. So this is a difficulty. The government are meeting on Tuesday to assess with as much accuracy as we can the cost of trying to repair the essential infrastructure that's been damaged because of multiple storms. And hopefully we'll have news for people on Tuesday or Wednesday.
OK, and I see RTE's Ciarán Mullooly is saying that water levels on the River Shannon have risen, but only marginally, yeah, after 12 hours of rain, because that's a major area of concern. There's no flooding risk to homes on the low-lying areas of Athlone, but the Athlone to Barrasochane Road is closed at the Anglers Rest due to flooding, just to keep people up to date on that. OK, we'll move on, because the Minister for Justice, Alan Shatter, has announced plans today to make it easier for people who've been victims of medical negligence to take a case against the state. Now, the proposed new open disclosure legislation comes in the wake of the RTE Investigations Unit programme about the deaths of babies in the Midlands Regional Hospital in Portlaoise. And to explain to us exactly what's being proposed, we're joined on the line now by Priscilla Lynch, who's a medical journalist. Priscilla, first of all, can you tell us how the state has dealt with medical negligence cases up to now?
Well, it's kind of a changing issue in the health services and in the state, I suppose. Originally, there used to be a sense of defensiveness and secrecy, and that still pervades, actually, in some areas where families have been forced to go to court to prove negligence. Now, in the last decade, there's been a lot of efforts by the state and the HSE, actually, to change this. And in 2012, HICRA published National Standards for Safer, Better Healthcare, which asks healthcare staff to fully and openly inform and support service users as soon as possible after an adverse event. There's also been pilots by the state claims agencies looking at hospitals where they've asked them to implement an open disclosure policy. It started off on two sites in the Mater and Cork University Hospital in 2011, and then last year it moved to 12 more sites. Ironically, actually, the Midland Regional Hospital Portlaoise is one of these hospitals where this has been piloted. And also,
it wasn't statutory though, was it?
No, see, this is the issue. Even in late 2013, the HSA itself published a new open disclosure guidance, national guidelines, which obviously was a big step there, and they're quite thorough. But again, as you've just pointed out, there hasn't been any legislation underpinning it, this. So there has been protocols, policies, national guidance put in place, but no actual legal legislation to really force.
So is it your view now that the prospect of legislation is as a direct result of what happened in Portlaoise and the revelations in that programme?
To be fair, it's been on the cards for some time. Actually, the Health Information Bill, which has been long awaited, was supposed to address the issue of open disclosure. Obviously, I'm sure the timing of the programme has helped push the Minister's hand there and actually admit that they're working on this in the background. But it has been in train for some time. And the various policies and protocols that I've mentioned there that have been put in place, these are all kind of seen as leading up to the legislation that will actually underpin what's going to happen. So they have been trying to pilot it and change the culture in hospitals. But as we've seen from that programme, this is not the case in all hospitals, so there have been a lot of improvements in the last decade. A lot of patients are still struggling to get answers and for mistakes to be actually admitted to them directly without them having to go to court to prove them.
Will this mean greater costs for the state if the hospitals admit negligence quicker?
No, the whole idea really behind it is that it'll actually be cheaper for the state as well as being much better for patients themselves. Open disclosure isn't about admitting liability. It's about really, I suppose, learning from mistakes and trying to ease the pain of patients and obviously to learn from the issues as well. So if they admit negligence at an earlier stage, it's hoped that actually less patients will feel obliged to take court cases. A lot of the time when you look back at cases even that are on TV on a weekly basis where patients have taken cases against the HSE or the state, all they say that they wanted to know was answers to what actually happened to them or to their loved one, and they wanted an apology and also assurances that this would not happen to other patients again.
Yeah, and it can go on for years, as we have seen. Priscilla, thank you for outlining that and what's happening there with the open disclosure proposition. Minister Coveney, can you frame for us really where this has come from and why it has happened now?
Well, I mean, Minister Riley for quite some time has been talking about, you know, the best way to guarantee patient safety is to empower and inform patients. And what we've seen, unfortunately, are cases where mistakes have been made, lives have been lost as a result of that, and the inquiries and reports into what happened have been kept from families. And that is disgraceful and should not have happened. But I think regardless of that tragedy, we have been moving for some time in a direction of a much more open health service, particularly when mistakes are made, so that we can learn from those mistakes and so that families can understand clearly what happened and why, and so that the resources of the state can be focused on damages, if that's what's necessary, but most importantly, on learning from lessons and making sure that we put systems in place to ensure that doesn't happen again.
Isn't it slow progress, though? Because we've all seen those cases where families will have to go to court and have these lengthy and horrendous ordeals over years and years and years in order to prove medical negligence.
Yeah, and we need to stop that. You know, I mean, what we do not want is to be, first of all, we shouldn't be spending money on defending the indefensible, but actually much more importantly than that, patients have rights here. When they're in the care of the state, we have a responsibility if and when mistakes are made that have a health consequence or some, in extreme cases, somebody may die. We need to ensure that families are part of the information gathering process and they understand what's happening and why what happened to their loved ones happened. Obviously, there is a judgment here as to how best to do this, as to whether we should just legislate requiring hospitals or medical practitioners to disclose under obligation when medical failures happen, or whether we use some kind of code of conduct to get better outcomes.
Well, it looks so we're heading for the legislation route, right?
Well, I think that discussion is at an early stage between the Department of Justice and the Department of Health, but certainly the discussion has begun. And if you look, for example, in numerous states in the United States, they do have an obligation to disclose, and that is in legislation. Others don't. And, you know, I think that we should allow both ministers to actually come up with an approach that will guarantee patient access to crucial information. And I think we've learned some lessons, tragically, that need to be fixed.
OK, Roisin Shortall, of course, former junior minister for health. Was this on the agenda when you were in the department?
Well, you know, legislation in this area, health information legislation, has been promised for some time, but there's been no timescale provided for it. And, you know, it is really important, I believe, that we end the culture of secrecy and cover-up that has, you know, been a feature of the Irish health system for so long. And as you say, where there is a fatal or a very serious incident, that heartbreak and grief that family members suffer is greatly added to by the denial of the responsibility, first of all, in relation to the hospital, and then by dragging out a legal case over many, many years, up to, you know, 10, 15 years. And that has to end. And I believe that there is a need for a legislative basis for that. It's not just about changing attitudes in the hospital, even though that is very important, but you also need the legislation underpinning that. And I take it from what Minister Shatter said this morning that work is going to start now between himself and the Health Minister on providing a basis in legislation for open disclosure. I think that's a welcome thing. I would have to say all credit to RTE's Investigations Unit for highlighting this issue in such a stark way in their programme last month, and indeed all credit to the participants in that programme, the parents of the babies that died unnecessarily, it would seem.
So while you were in the department, this wasn't on the agenda to put this sort of open disclosure on a legislative basis?
Well, it was promised, but the progress on it was very, very slow. And obviously in the highlighting of the issue again by RTE, that helped certainly to, you know, bring it to the fore and to prompt action by government. And hopefully we'll see that without any further delay now.
OK, I want to move on to another issue which is on the agenda today. The news, the government is looking again at alcohol policy, and the Junior Minister for Health, Alex White, your replacement, Roisin, said that this will end the policy of dirt cheap spirits and beer being sold at pocket money prices. But perhaps most controversially, the issue of drinks companies sponsoring sports teams and events is not going to happen. The ban is not going to happen. I doubt you're surprised at that.
Well, I'm not really, because I think a number of the cabinet ministers remain in denial about the scale of the problem that we have in this country with alcohol. It's extraordinary that in spite of all of the evidence that's there, in spite of the huge cost in economic terms and in personal terms, and the fact that we have a massive problem really with mental health issues relating to young people in particular, we know that alcohol fuels a lot of our social problems. It's a factor certainly in relation to the burdening of the health service. We know that some 2,000 beds are occupied every single night by people who have got alcohol-related problems. So, you know, the evidence is undeniable. But unfortunately, there are a number of cabinet ministers that refuse to take action in this area. We have had umpteen expert reports down through the years. Well, you know, I think it's well known who they are. There's certainly a handful of them. Some are very committed. They realise that this is a major issue in young people's lives in particular. They realise that, you know, it's costing us very dearly. But there are others that are in denial about this. And I believe that it's time for the Taoiseach to start leading on this, because the reality is that, you know, we know the alcohol industry is very well connected. It has very good access to a number of ministers, and it spends a huge amount of money on lobbying cabinet ministers to do their bidding. Now, the reality is that in this country, it's very easy to point the finger at young people, and people are very fond of doing that and saying the problem is with young people. The young people, by and large, copy what they see their parents' generation doing. And we know that right across the population, there is an issue about the overconsumption and the misuse of alcohol. And that needs to be tackled on a number of different fronts. But in spite of certainly umpteen reports that have been done, the most recent being 2 years ago, the steering committee's strategy that was drawn up to deal with this in a really comprehensive way that had a very strong evidence base. All of the people concerned, the relevant agencies, were involved in drawing up that strategy. And still the Cabinet is denying that that is the way forward.
But what Cabinet has done now is agreed what I see in front of me here, a fairly wide-ranging proposed legislation, you know, minimum unit pricing for retailing of alcohol products, the regulation of marketing and advertising alcohol, so there won't be advertising on television and radio
in the evening hours and so on. Do you not think, though, that progress has been made by virtue of this document we have before us today?
I think Alex White has been doing his best in very difficult circumstances.
But he's up against it,
He's up against it with cabinet ministers. And like,
okay,
the reality,
I want to ask, we have a cabinet minister with a
selection.
You've made the point about cabinet ministers being lobbied and being... Simon Coveney, your response to what Roisin's had to say.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, first of all, I'm in the cabinet. Right. So I've been involved in most of the discussions in relation to the new public health alcohol bill. I also think I should say that I think Roisin, when she was in the Department of Health, did a very good job in raising this issue in a major way in terms of forcing policy change. And, you know, she should be credited for that. Alex White has taken over that that baton and has done a great job in continuing to do that. The government never stopped looking at this issue. We have been continuing to look at it, and we are absolutely committed to a radical and fundamental reform in terms of producing a policy response to an alcohol problem that is clearly very evident in Ireland. We're going to be introducing minimum pricing to try and get rid of cheap drink that people can pick up for half nothing. We're going to stop retail outlets selling drink as a loss leader. We're going to introduce very tough regulations around advertising, around marketing of alcohol. We're going to be limiting radio and television advertising, cinema advertising, outdoor media. There's going to be mandatory codes of conduct. Currently, there's only voluntary codes of conduct. There's going to be structural separation in retail outlets in terms of where alcohol can be sold.
But there's still no ban on sports sponsorship.
I'm coming to that, Claire.
All right.
Because Roisin has made a whole series of statements that there are people in denial in the cabinet. There aren't people in denial. There is a uniform view in cabinet that we need to do something significant in this area, and we are going to do something significant. In relation to sports sponsorship, there was some disagreement on this issue. And what we have done, because it is not as simple as Roisin would suggest to simply ban all sports sponsorship. If we do that in the morning, there is a significant consequence for a lot of sporting bodies, a lot of sporting clubs across the country that have a significant revenue stream coming from sponsorship linked to drinks companies.
But you can do it over a long lead-in time,
yes,
and they can find
and what
sponsorship
we are doing,
elsewhere.
And we haven't said that that we're not going to ban sports sponsorship. What we've said is that we need to take a much closer look at it in terms of income loss, in terms of its effectiveness. And by the end of this year, a working group which is set up in the Taoiseach's department will have clear recommendations in relation to the link between alcohol and sports sponsorship. And that is very clear. And we've said that for the last 6 months. There's nothing new about this. So we're dealing with practically all of these issues. We're making major changes. On the one issue of sports sponsorship, we felt that there was more work needed, and that work will be done and finalised by the end of the year.
Okay,
so
just Alex White has been in touch with us to say that I misread what he said in his piece, and he's saying that I did not say that sponsorship ban was not happening. So I'm happy to clarify that.
Correct.
And I didn't suggest that was
I'm
the
also,
case.
I'm also clarifying that. The decision in relation to how we will manage sports sponsorship and alcohol is yet to be determined, and a ban is still potentially on the table, and a whole series of other options as well. So, I mean, you know, I think people should expect, because they're going to get a major change in terms of alcohol policy from this government. You'll see the legislation before the summer, and it'll be enacted before the end of the year.
My concern with this is that we haven't actually seen any action so far, in spite of all of the talk and in spite of all of the reports. We have a promise that some of the aspects of this, particularly minimum pricing, might be dealt with at the end of the year, but other much, you know, more tricky issues have been kicked down the road into a working group or a committee of some kind.
You're
or another.
You're talking specifically about sponsorship and
alcohol. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, there is an issue here, I think, that Simon needs to address as minister with responsibility for the food and drink industry. We cannot tackle the problem in any kind of serious way without reducing the volume of alcohol drunk in this country. And Simon seems to think that somehow we can wave a magic wand and we won't be affecting sales, but we can still tackle the problems.
No, sorry.
The point is that
Roisin,
it is
you're
not
making
possible
an accusation
to serve
that's
two
just
masters.
Simply not true.
It is
Claire,
not possible
let me respond
to serve the alcohol industry and public health.
Okay, we're going to move on to this.
Let me just be very clear, right? Because as part of our alcohol strategy, we are proposing that the amount of alcohol being consumed in Ireland is to reduce.
When?
And I'll tell you exactly when. The target is that by 2020, we in Ireland will be at the OECD average in terms of alcohol consumption, which is 9.1 litres of alcohol per capita.
That's purely aspirational we are currently, if you don't have steps to take that are clearly set out and agreed.
And I outlined a whole series of those steps.
That are being looked at.
Okay.
No.
We've got to move on from this.
We will have legislation published. We will have legislation published in this area by the summer. It'll be enacted by the end of the year. I mean, unfortunately, Roisin, because she started this process and did a very good job starting this process, seems to think now that because somebody else is finishing it, that she's trying to actually undermine
it. That's not true, but what I'm saying is that the alcohol industry has far too much access to ministers. And what concerns me is when ministers start using the language and the arguments of the alcohol industry, I am concerned at that point because I believe they're not serving the public interest.
Okay, Minister, respond to that and then we are going to move on.
Look.
Do you get lobbied heavily by the alcohol industry?
On this issue, no, to be honest with you. I can assure you that the decisions that are being taken around alcohol and all of the things that we've just been discussing are being taken on the basis of public policy around protecting people's health and around creating a more responsible approach towards alcohol consumption in Ireland.
Okay, we're going to leave that one there. After this next break, we're going to be discussing the homophobia row and the compensation paid to those who claimed they were defamed. This is Saturday with Claire Byrne. One of the big news stories over the last couple of weeks has been the debate around the alleged defamation of John Waters, Breda O'Brien and members of the Iona Institute on the Saturday Night Show. Now, this week, the Dáil debated the issue. The amount paid in compensation was confirmed as being €85,000 by RTE, and John Waters, as of yesterday, disputed RTE's version of how the settlement was reached. Simon McGarr is a solicitor and he's in the studio now. Simon, I know you've been following this very closely. You've been tweeting about it and doing your own research. One of the main issues here is the decision by RTE not to fight any potential litigation and to make that payment. And there has been so much debate around that. As a legal professional, what's your view on that decision?
I think that, first of all, RTE cited their senior counsel's opinion in their original statement to explain this. And their senior counsel was quoted as saying the legal issues weren't clear. And that's almost a statement of truth for all litigation before it comes to an end. No one can know how a piece of litigation will go until the verdict arrives. And defamation cases in particular, partly because there's a jury involved frequently, are notoriously difficult to predict.
So you've got to weigh up what your chances are of defending it successfully.
Both sides have to weigh up whether or not they're going to be successful. And in doing so, your legal advice that you get will tell you what your lawyer thinks your chances might be, with an enormous margin of error built in. But they will also ask the client, what is your appetite for risk? And if a client is risk adverse, you'll tell your client, well, this doesn't look like it's something for you. That if you can't take on a level of risk, if you're not comfortable with that, then you're going to need to have to settle. Mm-hmm. Or if you're a potential plaintiff, if you can't absorb a certain amount of risk, then you shouldn't go down this road in the first place.
Because a lot of the discussion has been around whether RTE's primary concern should have been financial pragmatism and getting, you know, the best deal, if you like, and in terms of the public purse and where the money comes from in RTE, or whether it should have been prepared to stand up for free speech.
Well, I mean, it isn't even an either or, because, of course, if you are successful and you win, the loser costs follow the cause. The loser naturally pays the winner's costs. And so the ideal would be to fight and win. And then there would be very little in the way of financial costs falling upon RTE were that to be the case. Rather, the question is whether or not a institution can bear to live with the uncertainty during the course of a piece of litigation, not knowing how a piece of litigation will turn out. that's very difficult for institutionally for a body like RTE, but also for any broadcaster. Certainty is always preferable for an institution than uncertainty, particularly if it goes on for a prolonged period of time. Questions of reputation, questions of judgment come into it. These are all uncomfortable things to find in the public domain. But I do think that you have to also ask of your potential imaginary client that you were saying, what are your principles? What are your red lines? Mm-hmm. What are the things that you are willing to fight for, even at the risk of losing? And that's really the question that any lawyer will ask their client. And given the answer that they receive, they'll say, well, in that case, I think you should do X or I think you should do Y.
There were calls during the week from some members of the Oireachtas for the legal advice received by RTE to be published.
I think that is an unfair request. I think it's important that privilege between a client and a lawyer remains privileged. RTE can waive its privilege. It can choose to do that. But certainly, I think it would be unfair to seek to compel advice to be opened. And I think it would be an unhelpful precedent. And that comes from somebody who may not be entirely happy with what that advice might say. But I think that principle is more important. That said, I do think it would be interesting to know what the sources of the advices were. Because there were two separate sorts of advice cited by RTE in their statement. There was the advice of the senior counsel, which, as I say, said that the legal issues were unclear. And then there was advice from internal and external legal advisers, which said that RTE would likely not succeed.
And why would that be important to know who those individuals were?
Well, it is a question of if your senior counsel hasn't told you that you won't succeed, who is it that you're relying on over your senior counsel's opinion? If the senior counsel says basically it could go one way, it could go the other. Now, these are questions about the relationship between the lawyer and the client, and it's always a sensitive relationship, and there has to be an ability for the client to talk to the lawyer frankly and vice versa. Otherwise, you would tie RTE's hand or any institution's hand from getting good legal advice.
And just a brief word, Simon, on one of the things to emerge from this, Minister Pat Rabbitt's proposed change to the broadcasting legislation. So we would go from preventing broadcasters from causing reasonable offence or asking broadcasters not to cause reasonable offence to undue offence. What's the difference?
Well, the actual legislation puts causing offence on the same level as undermining the authority of the state, as something that is to be avoided by broadcasters and is forbidden.
And offence is a very subjective thing, right?
It is. And also, there is an argument, and I would make this argument, though it is not yet the mainstream argument, I acknowledge, that causing offence is something which must be allowed to be aired if we are to have a proper and open set of free expression and the exchange of views. If we can only broadcast things which cause no offence to anyone, then we can never challenge the status quo. If everybody is happy with what is produced, okay, we're probably only producing baby food.
Minister Simon Coveney, you wanted to come in there on this issue. What's your take been on the debacle over the last number of weeks, and in particular over this week?
Yeah, well, I think it's a very unfortunate beginning to a national debate that we need to have, in the build-up to a referendum on same-sex marriage, which I'm looking forward to campaigning on, because I think it's the right thing to do, and sooner rather than later. And instead, we have been distracted now down the route of personalities, two journalists, the Iona Institute, and of course the one interview,
but we're talking about it. The argument has been made, or the point has been made rather, that we are discussing this in a very detailed way this far out from the referendum.
Yeah, and this is a conversation that Ireland needs to have, because it mightn't be politically correct to say it, but there is homophobia in Irish society, depending on how you define homophobia, but there are lots of people who are uncomfortable with same-sex relationships, and I think that that's something we need a conversation on, and it's something that we need to modernise around. I mean, this is a discrimination issue.
Okay.
It's an equality issue. It needs to be addressed. And if people love each other and want to spend the rest of their lives with each other, then the state should recognise and support that. And this, unfortunately, what has happened in terms of this this case where RTE essentially had to make a choice. They were facing 6 legal cases on defamation. And they made, for whatever reasons, legal advice and financial pragmatism, probably, that they wanted to settle this early and get and move on from it.
Okay, look, time is not our friend, Minister. I've got to go to Roisin Shortall before we finish. Roisin.
Yeah, all I'd say is I was absolutely astonished that RTE acted in the way that they did on the basis of what was said on that programme. I think it's very important that this issue be dealt with at an early stage, because we're facing into over 12 months of a debate on a fundamental issue in relation to human rights and civil rights in relation to the right to same-sex marriage. And, you know, my concern is that the national broadcaster has acted like this. I'd like to know what the internal advice within RTE was in relation to this. I think that's quite critical. And I'm also concerned about the fact that they acted so quickly in coming to a decision which a lot of people cannot understand within the space of 12
okay.
days. And I'm really concerned that that will have a chilling effect on an open debate okay. on civil rights issues.
We absolutely got to leave it there because the time is against us. Simon McGarr, thank you very much. Minister Simon Coveney and also Roisin Shortall. It's almost big match time. Saturday Sport is on the way. The team are ready and willing to go. We'll talk to you next Saturday at 1 o'clock. Thank you for listening.
Saturday with Clare Byrne was produced by Peter Woods. The researcher was Leslie Anderson. The broadcast coordinator, Maeve Mooney. And sound supervision was by Noel Roberts.